and welcome to Nature Now. I'm your host, Nan Evans, and my guest this week is Tim Lawson. We'll be up in the field on Chimicum Ridge, exploring the ridge through the eyes of a geologist and trying to understand more about the glacial history of our area. Now, some listeners may know Tim Lawson as the co-founder and past director of the Port Townsend School of Woodworking. But Tim has other talents as well. Tim was a field geologist in the United Kingdom, did mineral exploration in Australia, and has led all kinds of software engineering teams internationally. I learned about Tim's fascination with geology one winter. I was walking at North Beach, gazing at the Fort Worden Bluff face, and there was Tim, waving his arms in a massive explanation of bluff geology to a visiting friend of his. But today, a glorious spring day, we're going up onto Chimicum Ridge. Today's program is the first in a series of programs I hope to offer during the next year or two that will explore the natural history and human use of Chimicum Ridge. But before we start to explore Chimicum Ridge, let's hear this week's mystery sound. Tim Lawson, my guest this week, suggested this critter. Its distinctive song is heard commonly in the woods and open areas of Chimicum Ridge. Now let's go up on the ridge. I'm here on Chimicum Ridge with Tim Lawson. Some of you may guess Chimicum Ridge is, of course, close to the town of Chimicum. And it's this interesting ridge that separates the Center Valley area and the Beaver Creek Valley. We're up near the north end, looking across and seeing the landscape around us. Now, Tim, through the eyes of a geologist, as you first take in the landscape, how do you set the seed for us?
Well, the first thing I see is the big, broad expanse of Center Valley right in front of us. And also in my mind's eye, I'm seeing it when it's flooded in winter as well. So there's that lowland that, you know, holds a lot of water. But then as I look across the valley and we're sort of looking northwest over the high school, I can see Tamanuas Rock on the ridge over there.
Which is interesting. I, you know, talked a while ago with Jeff Tepper and Michael Michette on Nature Now and learned that that's the remnant of an ancient volcano, which fascinated me. But now, go on.
So we have that. So, you know, we have bedrock over there. And then as I look over to the west, I see the Olympics. And they're looking just stunning at
the
moment.
They are gorgeous today.
And then what we can't see from right here is that we have Beaver Valley behind us, you know, which comes in from the southeast to meet Center Valley, maybe just half a mile north of us. But the other thing that I'm seeing is right in front of us here from where we're standing on this old log landing is we're stood on the edge of a tree of old valleys. And it was these.
So this valley essentially runs more or less east to west down the slope.
And then goes out to the northwest.
Right. And you said trees, so that means there must be a lot of these.
Yeah, there's ones over here. There's a lot of them. And what I've got in front of me is this is the LIDAR map of this area.
Okay, first tell us what a LIDAR stands for.
Okay, well, LIDAR is light, L-I, detection and ranging. And this is a pretty sophisticated tool that's only really become broadly available in about the last 20 years. And what happens is they take a small plane up and they tow some instruments behind it that contains a laser that points down to the ground, and it fires little laser beams at the ground. And when it fires them towards the ground, that laser beam will either bounce off the top of the canopy or the ground. And so that when they later process these signals, they can give us a map either of the top of the trees, or they can give us this sort of X-ray vision of the ground. And this is kind of God's gift to geology.
And it's really fascinating because you kind of imagine, as we look out here, there's a lot of forest coverage and things you can't see. And this is like, in your mind anyway, removing all that plant coverage.
Completely.
And I'm seeing, first of all, I want to look at this. This is a Jefferson County map. Is it available to people, and how do they get it?
Absolutely. It's available off the county's GIS system, which they make publicly available. I go through it through the county assessor's portal.
Oh, right.
And, you know, there's a control panel there where you can select in the layers something called hillside elevation. And this is what we get.
And it's interesting to me, too. You can see the sort of the ridge, and it's kind of boat-shaped with the bow pointing north. And all these gullies coming off on either side. Then you see Center Valley running almost exactly north and south. And you see Beaver Valley kind of arching in from the southeast. So tell me more.
Okay, well, the thing that stands out to me about this is that we can see that Center Valley was existing before the glacier, or was amplified by the glacier, because we can see these north to south scour lines, these lines that the base of the glacier grooved into the landscape. Really, really clear.
I love groove, because my dad, and when we were growing up in the Midwest, always used to talk about glacier grooves, and he would take us up to the shores of Lake Erie to see such things. So grooves they are. Okay.
So we can see these really clearly here. What that tells us is that Center Valley was cut by the glacier.
Coming down from the north.
But what's really different is Beaver Valley was cut by floodwaters from the melting glacier going north and probably draining out maybe through Discovery Bay or maybe even through Port Townsend Bay. We don't know that.
Interesting. You're seeing that because of the way it curves in and then the lack of obvious grooves?
Absolutely.
Hmm.
And also, if we look at the map, and I've got two different scales of it here, I'm just looking at a very much smaller scale map, you can see this really obvious feature with very, very different topography.
Right.
The edge of Beaver Valley compared to Center Valley is really, really sharp and steep.
Right.
And that's what tells me it was cut late.
So, looking at this, the slopes on Center Valley are basically pretty gentle. You see a little bit of alluvial stuff, maybe, I'm guessing, down in there. So that valley is more U-shaped.
That's perfect, because the contrast would be that Beaver Valley is almost a V-sided.
Because it's got steep sides.
On both sides.
Which we know when we drive down one road or the other, but I hadn't really thought about it that way.
Yeah. So this is the beauty of this map, is it allows you to sort of go, huh, that doesn't look the same. And so what story is it that we can begin to build? And to me, one of the beauties of geology is we're always trying to build a story, tell a story from what we're seeing, and putting that story out until somebody else says, well, hey, I've got a slightly different twist on that story. So how do we converge on getting these stories together? But there's one related thing to all of this, and what I want to talk a little bit about is what happens when the glacier stops advancing.
Okay.
And we tend to talk about a glacier retreating. And the glacier doesn't suddenly go, well, I'm going to put myself in reverse gear and go backwards. It doesn't work that way. So what happens is the ice pushes down and it pushes down to the point where the climate is able to melt it. So it stops it moving. So the rate of melting equals or exceeds the rate of advance.
Or rate of freezing and moving.
It's a very complicated model. But the interesting thing is that if we think about down the east side of the Olympic Mountains, where is the greatest width between the edge of the foothills and open water? It's in the area of Chimacum Ridge and south to 104. So I'm suggesting that that was an area where we had a lot of stagnant ice, and stagnant ice is ice that's just sitting there melting.
Mm-hmm.
Because what we do know is that the ice reached its maximum extent at Tenino, south of Olympia, but then it melted back, so that the nose of the glacier melted back to about the Seattle area in 400 years. This was the Ferrari of glacial melting.
Yeah, that seems like a lot. I'm thinking about glacial melting rates these days and all we hear about the speed. Give me a, was it faster than the things are melting now?
I think it was faster.
Oh, curious.
I mean, I've read some accounts which say it was melting at 500 meters per year.
Wow, that is a lot.
So 500 meters, you'd see it.
Yeah, and that's a climate-driven issue?
Well, I think when it reached Tenino, that was a glacial maximum, which probably, you know, coincided with this maximum size of the Cordilleran ice sheet.
Mm-hmm.
But then as it started to melt, it, you know, that signified major climatic change. It was warming up, and the climate was able to melt that amount of ice. And what happened as that ice melted, well, there are a number of things going on, but as that ice melted, that caused sea level to rise. But what we have to remember is that at the Cordilleran maximum, sea level was 300 feet below where it is now. So if we think about that, and think about that, you know, the Cordilleran ice sheet, when it came south, there were two lobes. There was a lobe that went off south down Puget Sound, and there was another lobe that went off to the west down the Strait of Juan de Fuca. And what's interesting is that the splitting point was Skidder Hill. So the ice to the north of Skidder Hill went west. The ice to the east of Skidder Hill went south.
So for people who are not familiar with Skidder Hill, it's west of Discovery Bay.
It's got the radio towers on the top of it.
Yeah, okay. That's the easier way to do it.
Yeah, it's a big lump up there. I mean, it was completely buried under ice at one point, but in the early stages of the ice advance, the ice would have bifurcated and gone in two different directions there. Now, where was I going before we started that? We were talking about, you know, sea level being 300 foot lower. So if we take away 300 foot of sea level, and the ice was probably coming across that diminished lower sea level, so it was down here, it probably rafted across some of the water in the middle of the strait, and then it came up and over. And I think that the ice was coming south. Bear in mind that at that point, Chimacum Ridge was connected to the ridge that's to the west of Port Ludlow. That was just a continuous ridge. And it came up and over, and I think something strange happened, because I think as that ice came up and over the ridge, it was a sort of big roche moutonnée, which is a phrase from more alpine glaciers, where the ice comes over the rock and it leaves a pocket of sediment behind the rock. And I think what that did in this area left a lot of coarse sediment available. And I'm looking at our feet where we're standing, and I'm seeing a lot of medium to large size gravel with sand around it. This loose sediment, or really porous sediment, creates what I think of as a sponge on top of Chimacum Ridge that absorbs water over the winter and then releases it during the spring and summer.
So I also wanted to ask you, as we're looking at these LIDAR, we've learned in the last several decades to think about watersheds as systems.
Mm-hmm.
So as we're looking at this map from point of view of like today's water flow, you can pretty easily see that there's going to be water flow clearly down Center and Beaver Valley and down some of these sort of side marks. As you look at this and we look around, what's your concept of, is it all one big watershed? Is it a bunch of littler ones that combine to something bigger? Or what does this tell you about watersheds?
Well, I think it tells us that watersheds are very dynamic and they're not static. Looking at the map, we could probably argue that most of the flow that came out of Beaver Valley probably went into Discovery Bay.
Okay, because you can see that
you
looking
can see
like
this
a track.
Yeah. Yes, but what Chimacum Creek currently does is it comes down until it gets to about the airport,
and then it takes
a sharp east turn and it drains out.
Essentially, to Irondale. And,
yeah. Okay, I'm gonna share one of Tim's newer theories here.
Okay.
There's one of the things that happens is when you've got a big thickness of ice bearing down on the land, it pushes the land down.
Right.
And then as the ice melts, the land rebounds.
Yeah.
It's called isostatic rebound. And I think that from somewhere I am holding my pencil across a line going sort of northeast, southwest across the north end of Maristone Island that sort of connects there to Skidder Hill. I think much of the ice to the north of here, as the glacier diminished, actually rafted off down the Strait of Juan de Fuca. So I think this area lost its ice much sooner than where we are down here. And so I think this area
is
readjusted faster than down here. And I think that may have contributed
to the change of the water flow.
Yeah. Okay. So that's just a theory, because I don't understand why under the Strait of Juan de Fuca we have 3,000 or 4,000 feet of glacial sediment, whereas there's points here on Chimacum Ridge where we have 10 feet. Why is there so much sediment up there? And I think that's a much deeper question than the scope of this conversation. But to me, it's a really, really interesting question.
You know, one of the really fascinating things, Tim, here is to have a peek into your mind about when you look at what you can see on the landscape and when you see on these LIDARs and think about different theories that would explain. There's sort of a creativity and a fascination there that's like, wow.
Yeah.
What does this tell us?
Yeah, I mean, there's lots of interesting stuff. I mean, just as a very quick aside, if you look at the detailed LIDAR at the north end of Maristone Island, you can see there's lots of little beaches, just concentric little beaches around the water tower on the north end of Maristone Island. So there's lots of fascinating stuff. And let me just leave it at that, because otherwise I'm going to go off on a tangent.
Right. One other thing about this LIDAR image that I want to ask you about. So I'm looking, focusing back on the sort of boat shape of Chimacum Ridge. And down here near the stern of this boat, there's some really deep valleys that appear to cut across. What's going on there?
That's a great question. And I've talked about ice being stranded. I think there was ice sort of left up here on Chimacum Ridge for a while. Quite how long, I don't know. But we have one stream that drains down Chimacum Ridge.
And this is north to south.
From north to south. And then part of it drains out into Center Valley, and part of that same stream drains out into Beaver Valley.
Now that's downright weird.
Mm-hmm.
In my humble opinion. But
well,
yeah.
We have our own continental divide.
Right, okay.
Well, we have the Chimacum Ridge divide.
Right.
And I think there's a similar argument for what happens further south, you know, just south of mm-hmm. Egonai Road. But the area to this southwest here is a really, I think, of chaotic area where I think this really argues for, you know, the ice being sat here and breaking up in various ways and melting, and the impact of that melting really creating this topography that we see.
A lot of us think about Center Valley and Beaver Valley as just being this amazingly rich agricultural soil,
mm-hmm.
which presumably or clearly is related to glaciers. But are there other ways, or are there clearer ways that you can help us understand the fertility of those soils? And as you said, we're standing up here on the ridge on this mm-hmm. sort of bumbly mix of sand and pebbles, and across the way we see a bit of old volcano popping up. Set that in context for me.
Well, I think what we have to think about is, where do plants grow after the glacial maximum? You know, as the ice disappears and we've got this bare land, where are plants most likely to grow? Where there's water.
Wet and good soil, or some kind of soil.
Well, no, there's probably no soil there.
Oh.
You know, it's just glacial
wet.
It's just glacial outwash. So
helps me think differently.
So then what happens is the glaciers disappeared and the land's beginning to, you know, the plants are beginning to come back because it's getting warmer. There's birds flying over, dropping seeds. They're going to land where, you know, and a water course is going to be the place where they're mm-hmm. most likely to develop. And so I would argue that in Center Valley and both Beaver Valley, that's what was happening. In that post-glacial environment, there was just soil creation. The streams were meandering mm-hmm. across there. There were little oxtails and, you know, meanders, and they were filling up with vegetation. And then, hey, the beavers came along and helped the process along. So to me, it's really interesting to think about what does that mean in the mm-hmm. thing. So, you know, this is how landscapes develop. It's a very slow process. And we probably are seeing the result of about 15,000 years worth of activity.
Since that's the end of the last glacial advance. Here.
Yeah.
Yeah. One more question. As you ponder Chimacum Ridge and this area, is there one question that just intrigues you the most that you'd like to understand more about?
Yeah, what I'm really curious about was, what was the pre-glacial topography here like? Because Tamanawas Rock was probably a little bigger, a little taller. We know that at the south end of Marrowstone Island, we've got exposed bedrock here. We've got exposed bedrock in Beaver Valley. We've got exposed bedrock at the south end of Chimacum Ridge. What did the landscape look like? Were those cliffs, were those hills that the glacier interacted with? I know that there is a chunk of adakite, that's the material that Tamanawas Rock is made of, down in the south end of the property here. I got Jeff Tepper to identify it for me. So we know that, you know, there is rocks that have just been moved a small distance mm-hmm. here by the glaciers. So to me, there's a really interesting picture of what was the landscape like here. Because we do know that just down Center Valley Road here, there was actually mammoth skeleton found And I think that dated at about 22,000 years. So we know there's stuff was before here. And actually, from where we're standing right here, just down about 300 yards that way, I think there's a dating from some of the sediments down there of about 17,000 years. So we've got a complicated picture mm-hmm. going on here. And
well, this has been a fascinating conversation, Tim. And I'm thinking, of course, as is so often the case, I'm walking away with more questions than I started with.
Yeah.
Which is, to me, an absolutely successful toe-dipping into an interesting subject.
Well, my pleasure, and I'm glad to be that provocateur.
All right. Thanks again.
So let's hear that mystery sound again. That was the song of the common yellowthroat. Common yellowthroats spend much of their time sort of skulking low to the ground in dense thickets and fields. They search for small insects and spiders. And the males sing with that very distinctive and rolling witchety, witchety, witchety sound. During migration, this is often the most common warbler found in fields and field edges. A broad black mask lends a touch of, and I'm going to quote, highwayman's mystique to the male common yellowthroat. Females lack the mask and they're much browner, although they have some kind of warmish yellow around their throat. Well, that's it for this week's Nature Now. Thanks for listening. I hope you've enjoyed our program. This week's ending music is from the late 1940s. It's Red Belcher and the Kentucky Ridge Runners. I'm Moving On is the song.
There's a big eight-wheeler moving down the track. Means your true loving daddy ain't coming back. I'm moving on. I'm the rolling on. You're flying too high for my little old sky, so I'm moving on. That big loud whistle is she blew and blew. Says hello to the south, I'm coming to you. We're moving on, I'm rolling on. You had to laugh on me, so I'm setting you free. Keep a moving on. Fireman, won't you please listen to me, cause I got a birdie mama in Tennessee. Keep a rolling me on, I'm a rolling on. So shovel the coal, let this rattler roll, I'm moving on. Mr. Engineer, take the throttle in hand, we'll travel the fastest in the southern land. Keep a rolling on, I'm a moving on. You're gonna ease my mind, get me there on time. Keep a rolling on.